The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Greetings and welcome to another episode of Canadian History X. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. Growing up in the 1990s, there were a lot of great shows. And one show I enjoyed was The Drew Carey Show. And The Drew Carey Show led me to another show called Whose Line Is It Anyways? And it was on that show that I saw a Canadian, well, actually two Canadians, because Ryan Stiles is also Canadian, but I saw another Canadian named Colin Mochrie. And I've seen him in a lot of things. I've seen him in various shows. He did a wonderful cameo on Corner Gas. And I saw him just recently over Zoom, because we did an interview together. And we talked about his new show called Stream of Consciousness with Brad Sherwood, where they do improv over Zoom. It's a really cool idea. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the arts, the importance of the arts during COVID, and a whole bunch of other things. So I really hope you enjoy it. And let's get to it. How are you doing during COVID-19?
It's really hard to talk positively about a pandemic. But I have to say, it's been quite good for me. And please listen before people jump on. Right before the pandemic hit, I was doing two different tours, one with Brad Sherwood, and I was doing one with Asad Mekki, who's a hypnotist. And I was also filming a movie in Utah. So from January to March, it had just been insane, just going from one city to another, doing one project after another. Then it went from that to being in the vulnerable section of a pandemic. So I came back to Canada, and it was literally the first time in decades I had been home for this long. And it's been nice. It's been nice seeing my my wife, who I love dearly. Our daughter had been, she had kind of moved in just before everything happened. And so the three of us have had a sort of a good time amongst the anxiety of being in a pandemic with no work.
Got to find the positives.
Yeah, it's getting harder and harder. But yeah, it's been interesting.
Nice. With the pandemic, I've heard a lot of stand-ups will do shows over Zoom, things like that. But you don't hear too much about improv over Zoom. So how did the Stream of Consciousness, virtual Stream of Consciousness kind of come about with Brad?
Well, we realized, I think, fairly soon into it that, you know, my life for the past 17 years has been flying and theaters. And it seemed like those were kind of the two last things that were going to be able to function in a way that would feel safe to us. So we thought, well, why don't we try to we'll do our show on online? And we got together with our management team, and they had a tech crew, and we sort of worked out this new show. We realized fairly early on that it couldn't just be almost like a concert film of our stage show. You know, on stage, we can take more time doing scenes. We can, you know, interact with the audience more. When you're doing it on Zoom, you're immediately in television land. So people's attention sort of wanders off, you know, to whatever's happening in the room, or they have to look after the kids or the dog. So we came up with this, we sort of adapted some of our games and made it more of sort of an improvised sketch show where it's all totally improvised. We still get things from the audience through a technology I do not understand. We can actually go into people's living rooms and have them interact with us in scenes. So it's been interesting. I think what was great about it is it really gave Brad and I a creative burst of energy. We came up with all of these things to sort of get by past the obstacles of the technology and get to a point where we're really happy with the show.
Kind of in regards to that creative burst of energy. So it's kind of, like you said, for the past 17 years, you've been doing theaters and shows and yet Whose Line Is It Anyways? And so is this kind of like this new thing that you get to try and do with new challenges and new ways of looking at something you've been doing for so long?
Yeah, absolutely. There's limitations within Zoom, and there's another platform called Wirecast that we use in conjunction. Again, don't ask me anything about it. I don't know how they do it. But we, the first couple of shows we did, the tough part was, I'm acting with Brad, but there's also a monitor off to my side so I can sort of see that I'm sort of in the right spacing with him. And so the first couple of shows, that was in the top part of our brain, was the technical part of it. Mm-hmm. And then since then, we've gotten much more relaxed. We see that it works. And so we've actually started getting back to doing what we do in our show, having fun, kind of goofing with each other, trying to put each other in difficult spots. So it's been interesting. I mean, still, the weird thing is doing an improv show to no laughter, which Brad is totally used to. But it really throws me a little. On my monitor, I can see the audience in the Zoom, and I can see them laugh, but I can't hear anything. So I just assume, every show I just assume is a resounding success, and it's just being nonstop laughter. It's been weird having to have that extra thing of, nope, I'm pretty sure this is funny. I'm just going to go with this. It's been interesting.
So you have the audience, and the audience is a big part of it, but I guess what's the challenge with, because you're not on stage with anybody, like you said, to be interacting with another performer who is nowhere near you, but you kind of got to feed off their energy and them off of yours.
Yeah. It's interesting because Brad is in Las Vegas. I'm in Toronto. And again, through the technology, it looks like we're in the same room. Mm-hmm. And we can interact with. So there are some times where I'm actually fooled that we're in the same room, except that you're to my and there's the one there. But it's been, we still somehow managed to have the connection. And I think part of it is, we've been friends for over 30 years now. We've been touring for 18, almost 19 years. So there's that relaxation. It's almost like having a Zoom, a FaceTime with a friend or something. You're just goofing around, except that there's an audience who's paid money. But aside from that, totally the same.
How do you do the viewer engagement? Like how does somebody, I guess like some improv show, somebody will shout something out, but maybe that's hard with Zoom. So how do you get the audience engaged in what you guys are doing?
Yeah, we learned pretty early with when people start yelling in Zoom, people just, the speaker thing just keeps moving. So we on our main screen, we'd say, okay, we've broken the show into three different parts. So we get suggestions before each part. Mm-hmm. And we say, okay, we want to ask for suggestions. Then beside us, all the audience people are in their little squares, and we'll go, okay, I'm going to ask for, I need an occupation or something. And they will raise their hands, and then their screen will come up, and then we can actually talk to them a little bit. Where are you from? Blah, 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 blah. Give us the suggestion. Oh, that sucks. But anyway, we're going to do it. So it's nice. And a couple of scenes we have like straight interactions with them. So we still have that interaction that I think we were afraid we would lose in this format, because it really is a big part of our show. Us building a relationship with the audience and talking to them, having fun with them. Because they're, in our stage shows, they're our third improv member. They're giving us all the ideas. So we're trying to, you know, basically suck up to them so that they feel relaxed and are there to give us the best suggestions that they can and to help us get through the show.
Is there limitations to doing the improv? Like, could you do it with four other people, like you say would on stage? Or is kind of two kind of that sweet spot, because then it's just the two of you working together rather than a whole bunch of people trying to figure something out?
Yeah. In this kind of format, I think two is the best. I have done Zoom improv shows with larger casts. And there's sort of a moderator who says, okay, we're going to do a scene and it'll be Colin and whoever. So they fix it that way. But you can't, doing a group scene is really difficult. Mm-hmm. And it's really weird with everybody and they're becoming in their Brady Bunch squares trying to interact. And you're trying to, because, and the screens are different on everyone's thing. So you have no idea if you're looking at the right area. And you don't want to jump on someone's line. So yeah, two is perfect.
Any other challenges that you guys didn't really foresee other than like the obvious ones of nobody kind of being in the room with you and not being able to hear the laughter like you mentioned?
Yeah, I don't think there were anything. I mean, the first couple of shows, you know, things take you by surprise where you go, we didn't see that coming. Where it's like, oh, yeah, obviously, that's something we should have thought about. But it's gone smoothly. And as I said, the more we're doing it, the more fun we're having with it. And I think that's the thing we're going to find more and more as we get even more comfortable with the technology. And right now we've kept sort of one specific sort of set list of games we do, but we have a whole backlog of others but we just wanted to make sure that the concept kind of works, the premise works, and then we'll start putting new things in. And I'm sure we'll find new problems once we start doing that.
what's the response been like from the attendees being part of this kind of brand new experience?
It's been great. After the show, we have a sort of a Q&A so people can stay afterwards. And on all the shows we've done, it's always been over 90% of the audience has stayed. So I take that as a good sign that they haven't gone, turn this off. And the response has been very, very positive. People are enjoying it. And you know, it's right now it's the closest you're going to get to improv in the foreseeable future. So it's, and I think people have, you know, come in as a bit of a curiosity thing to see, well, how is this going to work? And by the end, are kind of impressed by probably more of the technology than us, but we don't care. As long as they keep there. Going.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. is it kind of, like when you're on stage in the crowd, you maybe don't always see the crowd because of lights and everything, but is it distracting at times to have all of these squares with all these people kind of staring at you and, you know, you're seeing into their house, you're seeing their dogs walking in the background or whatever?
Yeah. We don't have it up for the entire show.
Okay.
It is on the other monitor, but on the basic show, it only comes up when we're asking for suggestions. So, I try every once in a while, if I'm not quite sure, I'll try to sneak a look to see. Okay, they're laughing. All right, good. But yeah, most of the time, you just kind of, it's like any improv show where just, sometimes it's like almost 80% panic, where you're just trying to survive whatever the game is and working with a suggestion and your partner. So you don't really think about it until afterwards.
I feel like this is something that you provide that is really good for this time because, you know, a lot of people are still at home. You can only watch so much, you know, Office on Netflix or whatever. So is this kind of a good outlet for people that you feel that you're providing to them?
I think so. I think what this pandemic has shown is that the arts are an essential service. I mean, once everybody was sort of in lockdown, turned to Netflix and TV show, going to you know, shows they grew up with is sort of a comfort of viewing, and then live concerts. And this is just an extension of that. I think my hope is, and believe me, I'm not an optimist. I always am quick to believe in the worst of humanity. But my hope would be that people remember that during this time, they turn to the arts and that there'll be more support of it as things move on. That is my wish. So, you know, we'll see if that happens. That being said, there have been times where I have been sort of uplifted by humanity during this time. I've seen some amazing things done by people. And the frontline workers, kudos to all that they have done. So I hate when I have little bits of optimism burn in me because I feel I'm just going to get disappointed. But this time feels a little different. I think that the little flames of optimism could burst into giant fire, change and goodness.
It kind of in relation to that, and like you said, I don't want to be, you know, saying, oh, the positives of COVID, because there's many, many negatives to it. But could one of the positives be more people, like you said, seeing the arts as not just something that, you know, you watch or do on a Saturday night, but a vital part of you know, our experience as a culture and something that we very much need?
Absolutely. I mean, people sort of take it for granted, but I think if all of a sudden there was nothing, there was no television, there was no music, there was no art, that would leave an incredible gap in our lives and what we do and how we interact with each other. And the ideas we would miss because of the ideas art puts out. So I hope, come on, people, make the arts as important as the military, as important as anything else we have in our countries, because it truly is. And you all know this. If I said to you, hey, you know, what's your favorite TV show? What's your favorite piece of music? What's your favorite piece of art? If I said, who is your favorite military general? You'd stop and have to think for a while, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
Art, that's the way to go.
Just to step back a bit, but tell me a bit about your book, Not Quite the Classics.
Oh, yeah. I was basically forced to write this book. My agent, who loves finding me kind of work all the time, said, you know, you should write a book. I said, but I don't want to. I don't have anything that I'm, you know, dying to write. And it's work. I mean, it's a lot of work. And part of the reason I'm an improviser is I'm lazy. I like to be able to go somewhere where, oh, no, I could just make up crap. It's fine. That's my job. And so based on that information, he got me a book deal. So I had to come up with something. So I thought, oh, what would be the least amount of work could do to write a book? And I thought, oh, I don't want to do a life story because my life truly isn't that interesting. I've been incredibly lucky. I love what I do, but you know, it maybe be a good pamphlet and that's it. So I thought, why don't I improvise? So there's a game called First Line, Last Line, where you get the first line from the audience. You get the last line of the scene from the audience. So you have your beginning and end, and then you use that beginning to make up the middle to get to the end. So I thought, I'll get the first and last line of classic novels and then make up the middle. So the first problem was finding classics that had a great opening line and a great closing line. Sometimes they had one, sometimes they had the other, but to find one that had, so that was a problem. And then the first story I did was the Sherlock Holmes one. And it was like drinking wine. It was just so easy. It just flowed out. I thought, oh, this writing thing isn't so bad. I'll be done this book in a week. And that was the last good moment I had. And then from then on, I was just like, oh, how does Stephen King write a book every year that's 2,000 pages long? This is insane. I can see why they all drink. But I got through it, and there was a sense of pride that I did get through it, and I was happy with most of it, which was good. And then, you know, people always say, you know, so you're writing another one. It's like, no, you know, it's it's not like childbirth where you forget the pain and decide to have another one. I remember every bit of pain of writing that book.
One so, and done.
Yeah. Unless something spectacular comes to me and I need to do something, but I wouldn't count on it.
So other than the Zoom shows and everything, kind of what have you been doing with your time over the past, I guess it's been like 6-7 months now.
Yeah. Doing a lot of podcasts. I've done some improv shows with, young troops across America, which has been interesting because I always, when we, you know, worked on stages so long ago, I always enjoyed working with improv troops that I didn't know because I found it sort of got me back to my basics of actually having to listen and supporting and being surprised. So it was always sort of a good refresher course, kick in the butt kind of thing. So I've been doing that, and then mostly cooking. I've done all the cooking in our marriage since 1990, because at the time we were living in Los Angeles, my wife was doing a television show that she had created, and she'd always hated cooking. So I said one day, I had no papers, I couldn't work in the States, so I was basically looking after our newborn, who was like 3 months old at that point. So I said, hey, Deb, this cooking thing, do you just look at recipes and do it? And she went, yeah, that's all you do. So I started doing it and loved it. So cut to, how many years? 30 years later. My wife has developed a gluten-free problem, a gluten problem. Mm-hmm. My daughter is pescatarian, and I'm a carnivore. I'll eat anything. So basically, it's I've been sort of dabbling in amateur restauranteering, coming up with menus where everybody can enjoy it and people won't get sick. So that's taken a lot of my energy.
What about after, hopefully, you know, when COVID eventually we get a vaccine or something, but what do you hope to be doing after COVID? Do you have any plans for that? It's kind of hard to say because we don't really know when that will be, but.
Yeah, I really feel theaters are going to kind of be the last to come back. I have been doing some television, which is interesting because, you know, of course, it's totally different to anything that's happened before. Now you go, you get your temperature taken, you fill out a form, mm-hmm. Everyone's separated. You have masks on until they say action. Then you take your mask off, you act, then you put them back on. So it's been, and I have to say, the shows I've worked on have been very, very good at obeying the law and making sure everyone feels safe. You know, there's big partitions between everyone as they're getting their makeup done. Everybody has their own makeup utensils that nobody else's use. There's no craft tables anymore. There's, when you get your lunch, you just pick up a bag. So it's been interesting sort of adapting to that and seeing how that works. So I know I have a couple of more television things to do. You know, I'd love to get back on stage. Again, I don't know when that'll happen and how it's going to happen. It's weird to think to be in a theater and having pockets of people throughout the theater. But who knows? I mean, the beauty, as you can see from, if you studied my career, I have no idea what goes on. I just go from place to place and end up, you know, yeah, I'll do a Shakespeare thing. Yeah, I'll do this, I'll do that. Whatever makes me uncomfortable, I enjoy doing because I find that's when it's most fun for me.
That's good, because you can adapt to things like this a lot easier than other people.
I tell you, that yes and has really helped during this time. guys, if you're feeling anxious, go out and take some improv classes. I tell you, you'll get through this.
And then just my last question is, how do people register or attend the Stream of Consciousness improv shows?
Hey, that's a good question. I feel I should have that on my fingers. There is a website, passportshows.com, and that has a listing of our shows coming up. And I think you can just click on there and it will take you to, I think this week we're in Akron. We're in Akron somehow. And then we have some UK dates later in. I love the fact we're touring the world and I'm in my basement. It's like the best of all possible worlds.
In relation to that, I kind of forgot to ask, but so you focus on, it's not just like somebody from London and somebody from Las Vegas and somebody from Florida. It's specific locations that you guys kind of focus on for the Zoom improv?
Yeah, anyone around the world can go to any show, but every week it's done through cooperation with a specific theater somewhere. So I think they open it up to their subscription base first, but you can always get in. We've done shows and we have people from New Zealand, Abu Dhabi, and like people who are watching this at like 3 a.m. in their country. So God bless them. Thank you. So yeah, if you want to, watch it from anywhere.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Colin Mochrie. And if you did, please leave a rating and review. You can reach me at craig@canadaehx.com. You can visit my website where you'll find hundreds of articles, including all of my podcast episodes. Just go to canadaehx.com. And again, you can support the podcast at Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/canadaehx. Just like all of these wonderful patrons have. Aaron O'Hara, Robert Dunseith, Todd Casey, Catherine Roy, Luke S., Vic Hedges, J.P. Bear, Jason Hall, Phil Maynard, Spencer M., and Iris Gray. Thanks, and we'll see you again next time.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.